This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
Hear about a new grant that'll train nurse practitioners in rural and underserved areas, because people often don't seek treatment when healthcare isn't close by.
Things that could be treated earlier and managed better maybe are not managed well until it becomes an emergent situation.
You'll hear from Mennonite College of Nursing's Jessica Sullivan, and meet a Bloomington woodworker whose masterpiece is a church, and learn about one of this community's earliest feminists. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Where you live can affect your access to primary care. A small town may not have enough doctors. Someone in a low-income urban area may not have access to a car to even get to the doctors. Illinois State University's Mennonite College of Nursing is trying to tackle the health needs in rural and underserved areas through its Family Nurse Practitioner Program. And it just got a big federal grant, $2.8 million, to help it train the next generation of nurse practitioners. I spoke to the head of that program, Jessica Sullivan, about filling the gaps in America's healthcare system.
We have a lot of rural settings in central Illinois. We live kind of in the middle of several rural communities, so 15, 20-minute drive and you're basically in the country. Some places where we have students quite frequently for clinical would be like Farmer City, Gibson City, so just east of town. We have students up in the Pontiac area, Clinton. So really all of the surrounding areas.
What sort of access to primary care do those communities have today?
Well, traditionally, rural areas do have a shortage of healthcare workforce. So they definitely have fewer physicians and nurse practitioners than we have in the Bloomington Normal area or Peoria, Champaign, Urbana. It seems like they're always looking for more providers. They're always looking to expand because the more access that people have to primary care, the healthier they are.
Yeah, can you expand on that a little bit? What are,
sure.
When you don't have enough physicians, say, to in a smaller community, I don't know, how does that affect patient decisions and the options they have for where they go?
Sure. So when there are not enough healthcare providers in a rural setting, for example, people that live in the area may not seek care as soon as they would if they had access to a healthcare provider in a bigger city. So certainly things that could be treated earlier and managed better maybe are not managed well until it becomes an emergent situation. So, for example, someone having chest pain, they could possibly, likely be treated sooner and maybe avoid a heart attack, where someone who does not have access to care may not have someone that they could see for that treatment. And then, you know, there could be a really poor outcome.
Are there other unique challenges that come with providing primary care in these kind of rural and underserved areas that you're talking about?
Well, I think that rural and underserved areas are quite different.
Give me an example of an underserved area that's not rural.
Underserved area, for example, we have had students with Heartland Health Services in Peoria, in the Peoria area before. So their organization is federally funded, and they really focus on providing care to everyone, but they traditionally provide care to patients who might be underinsured. Patients who have other social, the social determinants of health that we talk about, things like lack of access to transportation, lower socioeconomic status, those types of things. So they really look at not only treating the health of the patient, but also those social factors that really can determine a person's health and well-being.
So where do nurse practitioners come in here? How does the role of nurse practitioner help address some of the gaps that you've just kind of walked us through?
We at Mennonite College of Nursing, we're training our family nurse practitioners, and they are really well poised to go out and provide primary care to patients. So when we talk about primary care, it's things like health promotion, disease prevention, early intervention, to hopefully minimize the long-term outcome and maximize, you know, the health outcomes for patients.
Hmm. So that's what they do. How do you think training more family nurse practitioners, especially in these rural and underserved areas, how do you think that will help kind of fill the needs that you've kind of just walked us through a moment mm-hmm. ago?
You know, really it comes down to improving access to care. So nurse practitioners across the board really provide high quality care. And if we can get more of them out there, then there are more providers for the patients to see. And so they can get in sooner when we are focusing more on health prevention or health promotion and disease prevention rather than treatment of illness.
So for our listeners who may not know the difference between a family nurse practitioner and a traditional registered nurse or a physician, mm-hmm. what are those differences? Where does an FNP, a family nurse practitioner, fit into that spectrum?
Sure. So looking first at nursing, all nurse practitioners were first registered nurses. So we all have that really strong background of nursing. Again, health promotion, disease prevention, a really strong focus on the patient, family, and community. Public health is another strength of nursing. And so those of us who are family nurse practitioners all are also registered nurses. A registered nurse has a 2 or 4 year degree. And then in order to become a family nurse practitioner, you have to have a master's degree in nursing. And then you have to take a certification exam that makes you nationally certified as a nurse practitioner. In fact, really the push now is to have all nurse practitioners be doctorally prepared. So to make the DNP, which is a Doctor of Nursing Practice, or the PhD, the degree that allows them to enter practice. So there's a push for that doctoral preparedness because that's the terminal degree, and that puts us on the same level as like a medical doctor as far as having that terminal degree. And so that's been a big push lately. So a family nurse practitioner is either master's prepared or doctorally prepared. And a family nurse practitioner and nurse practitioners in general, they receive training on advanced physical assessment, advanced pharmacology, diagnostic reasoning skills. So coming up with a differential diagnosis of what's going on with a patient and then formulating a plan from there. And then we do a lot of clinical hours. So like through our program, we do 660 additional clinical hours with patients in all different settings. We focus in our FNP program on primary care. So we do pediatrics, women's health, family, geriatrics. So we get a really good base of really the lifespan.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio with Jessica Sullivan, the family nurse practitioner sequence leader at Illinois State University's Mennonite College of Nursing. So Jessica, under your leadership, the college was recently awarded a $2.8 million Advanced Nursing Education Workforce, or a new grant, from the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration. So what is the college's history with this particular grant program? Is this money you've gotten before, and this is just more of it? How does that work?
Okay. So yeah, this is actually a continuation of a previous grant that we had under Dr. Denise Wilson. She had applied for and received this grant in 2017. So at that point, it was a 2-year grant, and that was over at the end of June. And she and I worked together to write this grant, and we were awarded the grant to begin then again in July of this year. So July of 2019 to June of 2023. So it's now a 4-year grant. So really the focus of the grant is very similar to what it was in the previous 2 years. Again, like you said, focusing on enhancing training for advanced practice registered nurses, like nurse practitioners, enhancing their clinical rotations, and really focusing on rural and underserved populations. And another big part of this grant is that we will be developing an academic practice partnership with one of the local healthcare organizations, again, to really try to enhance clinical training for our FNP students.
Is academic a practice partnership you're referencing? Is that with Chestnut Health System?
Yes.
Yeah, so how is that going to look?
So it's really exciting. We've had a meeting with them, and I think that it's going to be very beneficial, hopefully, for both Mennonite and Chestnut Health Systems. But for us in particular at Mennonite and our students, it really offers us a broader pool for clinical preceptors for our students. So we will have more access to those people who are experts, especially in mental health and substance use disorder. We are focusing some of the grant on that. So it will definitely enhance the experiences for our students. And also, we're hoping that the experts there at Chestnut may be able to help us develop some patient simulation scenarios for our FNP students.
How will it benefit, do you think, some of the rural and underserved areas that you've been talking about to have family nurse practitioners who are better versed in addiction and substance abuse treatment and that world?
Yes. I think that, again, it goes back to access. You know, in the rural and underserved settings, the patients not only have lack of access to primary care, there's also a widespread lack of access to mental health and substance use disorder treatment. And that is traditionally an area where most primary healthcare provider training programs don't spend a lot of time or don't have a lot of time to really adequately train their students. So this has been an area that has been a little bit lacking that we're trying to really bolster so that the students are able to not only take care of the physical health of the patient, but also the mental health of patients.
Well, something else I wanted to ask you about that I think you're working on is the development of a center for senior advocacy at ISU that would help community-dwelling older adults, you know, safely, comfortably, and independently stay in their homes. Where are you at with that project, and how much progress has been made?
Yeah, we are working on all of these activities as we speak. I envision this as a collaboration across different departments at Illinois State. So we are developing currently a survey to send out to the different departments to really just kind of gauge interest in participating in this, and also to find out what different departments have been offering, you know, have offered in the past or are currently offering for our older adults in the community. So it's really still in the early planning stages. I would say that of all of the grant activities, this is the one that has the most opportunity to develop and grow. And so we're looking for input from different departments, and we hope that it can really be a campus-wide collaboration.
So what are the gaps in the community or the needs in the community that sparked interest in even creating something like this?
You know, there's this whole idea of what's called aging in place. And the research has shown that the majority of people would like to live at home for as long as possible. So the main idea of the Center for Senior Advocacy is to help people to do that. So there are so many opportunities that we could address here. You know, physical needs in the home, grab bars in the bathroom to help to prevent falls, you know, wheelchair ramp, things like that, that would maybe otherwise, you know, without those things, the home would maybe be unsafe to remain in. So it's those physical needs, but also the more that I'm looking at the research, there are really social needs for our older adults as well. Social isolation and loneliness are really significant, can be significant problems for older adults living in the community. Another thing is food insecurity. So I believe that we could really work with several departments to help meet these needs for our older adults living in the community.
That's Jessica Sullivan, the Family Nurse Practitioner Sequence Leader at Illinois State University's Mennonite College of Nursing. She recently helped win a $2.8 million Advanced Nursing Education Workforce Grant from the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from SmartVet, the only mobile veterinary practice serving the Bloomington-Normal area. Your pet's healthcare experience is simplified when the vet comes to you. Details at thesmartvet.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Many artists love the next project and the next and the next. Here's one who is constant in his attention to one big thing, a church, in fact. Though Andy Berkey doesn't think he's really an artist, or a craftsman, or a gilder, artist, tradesman, Berkey makes his living carving, casting, and coloring traditional Gothic furnishings for Catholic churches. Berkey tells WGLT's Mary Cullen that he prefers the term maker, a title in the gray area between trade and art.
35 years ago, I broke into the trades as a carpenter and then eventually gravitated towards finished carpentry and furniture building. Then it became a little more weird because I came into using those skills in more of an art sense for church furnishings and especially with Gothic furnishings. So I say I live in a gray area between art and trades because I talk a little too much art for the trades, and the art community's not sure where to put me because I don't have the credentials that's needed to be, I think, truly recognized in the art community.
So you just recently started seeing yourself as an artist, and you explained a little bit earlier, but I'm going to ask you to go a little bit more in depth on what exactly it is that you do create so that listeners can see and maybe decide for themselves if they view you as an artist.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to ask, to have somebody make the decision whether you're a tradesperson, an artisan, or an artist. And I'd like to say that I could delineate between those three, but I can't, because I put myself squarely in all three categories at different times during even the day. So, you know, I cheat. I have told you that I'm a professional cheater. I try to make 600-year-old style furnishings as efficiently and as affordably as I can.
So your primary target are these smaller churches, mostly Catholic churches, not all Catholic necessarily, but smaller churches. Can you explain your process of how you do create this work in a more modern way while still holding the tradition of the style?
Well, it is all about the style. The style is the beginning and the end. How I get there is up for negotiation. So, for instance, I can carve wood. I don't consider myself to be a wood carver. However, I have had to acquire that skill to do this type of work. However, my goal is to do as little of that as I can and achieve the visual impact. So what I will do is carve one item that is repeated throughout a furniture piece, and then you know, in the last 20 years, there's been huge advances in molding and casting materials. So I can carve one and make a mold of it and then cast it in really modern. I can make plastic in my shop that is durable, light, and is an exact replica. I guess I'm a bit of a romantic when it comes to old churches. So, yeah, I do have my eyes always out. If I'm at Third Sunday Market, you know, a flea market or antique stores or anything, a lot of these pieces were taken out in the 70s in an effort to modernize a lot of the older Catholic church. And every once in a while, if you have your eyes open, you'll see a piece or two of those around, and people don't really even know what they are, but I will grab them and I try to integrate those old pieces whenever I can into the new furniture that I build. And it's a bit of a homage to the builders that were that did it originally. And I don't know, it just feels right. You know, it feels like you're taking the spirit of what was and inserting it into what you're building.
If you could explain a little bit of the pieces that you do put together so that they can understand and maybe visualize it themselves.
What we're trying to do a lot of times is, especially in the altar area where people are looking at the priest, you know, giving communion or reading a homily or whatever they're doing, even, and more importantly, you know, fancy things like weddings especially. And we're trying to make a visual throwback to the original furnishings that were there, which were Victorian Gothic a lot in this area, 100-year-old interpretations of Gothic architecture. And so that's the altars, the pulpits. Sometimes I've built a high altar piece, which was 29 feet tall. They're all over the place, but it's the furniture that creates the atmosphere.
And then growing from that point, how do you feel as the person who's putting together these pieces, knowing that those pieces can have long-lasting impacts on the people around them, whether you're getting married under that altar or a funeral of a loved one? How do you feel knowing that your art, I will say, is having an impact on those around it?
Well, this is a heavy one. To be honest, I've got goosebumps right now. When I was finishing that 29-foot altarpiece, we had finished the St. Mary altar, which I believe was about 20 feet tall. And one of the guys that I was working with said, "Hey, there's somebody crying in front of the St. Mary altar." So I turned around and there was mid-80s-year-old man. So I went down and asked him if there was anything I could do, if I could get the priest for him. And he said, "No, you've done quite enough." And, you know, of course, you're like, "Oh, man, what did I do?" And he said, the last time that I saw this altar, my wife was kneeling at it at our wedding. And, dude, I just about, I mean, I get, you know, creepy, crawly skin right now thinking about it. But that's the kind of thing that you realize that this is heavy stuff. And that's why I'm a pretty irreverent guy. Generally, I'm an old punk rock guy, right? So that's my default setting. But in this stuff, I flip right to the other side of the coin. And it's full reverence. And there's no joking around about it. It's, it's a heavy thing, you know, to know that those pieces could be influencing people's, how they feel at their wedding or their funeral or their baby's baptism or high points of their life or low points. You're there to sort of make a frame for what they're going through at that point. It's not lost on me for sure.
So we've talked a lot about how parishioners view your work. How do you view your work?
That is an amazingly good question. There's a sense of responsibility both to the parishioners, but I also feel a huge responsibility to the artisans and tradespeople that built these buildings 100 years ago. You know, a lot of times they were just doing work, but yet they did work at such a high level that we have to call ourselves artisans or artists to match that work. So yeah, basically I carry a lot of people on my shoulders and I try to keep all those guys front and center, as well as my grandpa. You know, my grandpa there's a picture of him hanging in my shop and, he was a farmer. And then he took up woodworking, and then eventually later on in his life, he took up weaving. But he was always making. And to me, that's, even as he deteriorated physically, he found something new, a way to reinvent himself. And I carry that too, because that's my responsibility to do well by my talents.
Getting back to that theme of the Catholic churches, you've told me that a majority of the work that you do is for Catholic churches. Are you Catholic?
I am not. I practice an odd form of Buddhism, and which seems incredibly odd, but one of the tenets of my belief system is that it's necessary for me to have as little of my own ego involved as humanly possible. So going into a new room, a new church, I think it gives me a little bit of an advantage that I'm not really looking at it through any kind of lens, or that's my goal, is to look at it with very fresh eyes, with, you know, a 12-year-old's eyes, and see a room that I get to play in and make. I say that a little bit flippantly. I don't mean that. But, you know, I get the privilege of making that room more historically accurate.
You say that you are practicing Buddhist. What do the leaders of the churches that you go into say when you say that you are not Catholic and you're still crafting these pieces that are going to finally lay in a Catholic church?
It's kind of, I'm very upfront about it, and I've never really gotten any kind of negative reaction to that. I have studied for a long time in the iconography of the Catholic Church, the style of architecture that I mainly deal in. You know, one of my favorite things that I own in the entire world is a 1930s traveling salesman's catalog of Gothic altars and furnishings. And, you know, I bought it on eBay, and it's just this kind of, I feel like Harry Potter and, you know, a book of spells or something, because this is classic Gothic architecture that is just a huge category of knowledge for me. It's like this encyclopedia. So there's a lot of knowledge that I bring that even a lot of artisans who are Catholic, they don't have the depth of knowledge, which I think especially the priests appreciate. Frequently, I will be asked by parishioners when I'm on site if I am Catholic. And I had a priest probably 20 years ago who is a good friend of mine. He laughed when he heard this question, and he responded to the parishioner, "He's not Catholic, but he's more Catholic than most Catholics."
That was Andy Berkey, a Bloomington Normal maker specializing in traditional Gothic furnishings, speaking with WGLT's Mary Cullen. Berkey has worked on St. Pat's Church on Bloomington's west side, was part of the church's renovation. This is Sound Ideas.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, America is getting ready for legalized betting on sports. We look at the likely winners.
We've seen hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of bets made since we launched, and seems to be getting bigger every month.
And the potential losers.
We do know that gambling is associated with lots of bad social effects.
The economics of sports gambling, that's next time on Freakonomics Radio. I'm Stephen Dubner. It's Freakonomics Radio, Saturday at 6 p.m. on WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit for over 40 years and now expanding the campus in Bloomington. New Westminster Village assisted living and memory support facilities currently under construction. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Just ahead, meet one of Bloomington Normal's earliest feminists. But first, the debut album from Jason Hawk Harris on Bloodshot Records is an Americana gem that many are calling one of the best albums of the year. It's not surprising Harris gravitated to the honky-tonk country popular in his native Texas as a backdrop for Love in the Dark. He says the album is full of love songs wrapped in a layer of grief, or grief songs wrapped up in love. WGLC's John Norton caught up with Harris via Skype ahead of his show tomorrow at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington. Found Harris at a few musical supervisors' surprises up his sleeve.
Well, I think it's about time I had a drink. up under my sink.
Bloodshot Records, in a recent Facebook post, said if Jason Hawk Harris isn't selling out Nashville's world-famous Ryman Auditorium in the near future, something would be amiss. That shows the label's confidence in this emerging Americana star.
It's what I do every time I see you walking around. I've been cussing at the light. I can't wait until it's night.
As you listen to the song Cussing at the Light from the new album, it may surprise you that Harris has a strong background in classical music, even attending college at Biola University Conservatory of Music in Southern California. Also, somewhat surprisingly, it was the rock band Queen that ignited his passion for classical music.
I know Freddie Mercury and Brian May were both big classical music buffs, and so at first it was Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms, but then I got really, really into modern and contemporary classical music like Stravinsky and Shostakovich, and then going up to even the avant-garde like George Crumb and Penderecki and John Cage. That's where I really found a lot of interest there. But I mean, what started my interest in classical music was actually Queen.
You might discern a classical influence on the album's lead track.
I certainly think orchestrationally, definitely, the arrangement in regards to what instruments are playing what, in what ranges, and, you know, having some strings in there. I think my songs are still largely song structured. But I hear
you calling my name. Harris said if he told a classical composer with an already upturned nose that his songs were classically influenced, he said that composer would probably turn his nose even higher.
There's a lot of weird stigmas in the classical music world, especially in composition, about what they call program music, which is music to a program rather than music for music's sake.
When Harris decided to make music his job, playing country and honky-tonk was an easy choice. It's the music he grew up with in Texas. He recalled two-stepping to George Strait and Alan Jackson songs early on. It's not something you can really avoid growing up in Houston. But he was also heavy into the punk scene during his middle and high school years. It was a group, he said, that didn't look favorably upon folks like George Strait and Alan Jackson.
When you grow up in Houston, Texas, and you're in the punk scene in Houston, Texas, you do not want to admit that you like country music. So I feel like I kind of, you know, even though I did like it, I had an affinity for it, I sort of hid that, because when you're a kid, you know, you just want to fit in.
College was a different story. He returned to listening to country music while he was at the conservatory. Then shortly after graduating, he heard Michael Daves and Chris Thiele's Sleep With One Eye Open album.
I don't know, something snapped. I'm gonna sleep with one eye open from
now on. At that time, he was on a wait list for UCLA's grad school for composition.
So I was waiting around to see if I would get in to make the cut. And I heard that record and I just was like, I think this is all I want to do. So I went and bought a Martin D28, and that was it. I joined a bluegrass band and was in that for a while. And then once that broke up, that's when I started my own thing.
It's ironic now that his label, Bloodshot Records, is known for its many artists that mash punk with country music.
Exactly.
Though he landed on Bloodshot as much for his sound as his musical talent, Harris is also a nifty lyricist.
Someone told me that I should get myself together. There's no need to rush the old I do. And how foolish they would feel speaking in such platitudes if they had to do so standing next to you.
I got married young. I was 23. The reason we got married so young is because we had been dating for years and we were just like, this is it. I don't know what we're waiting around for. Let's just do it.
Someone told me once that I should make a little money before I rush to put a ring on you. Like a bank account could teach me what grief and God ain't taught me, and IRA just gives me more to lose.
That someone referenced in the first line of that passage was an older acquaintance of Harris's who offered pre-marriage advice, including must have $50,000 stashed in an IRA before you say I do. Harris said he kind of felt sorry for the man.
It felt like he had gotten so far away from how it felt to be in love that he couldn't remember that would mean absolutely nothing to a kid that was head over heels in love that just wanted to get married.
I'm confused, yeah, it's true. What's that got to do with me and you? Why can't I be in love? Why can't I be in love? Why can't I be in love?
The grief he hints at in Confused and this song called Giving In is deep.
The liquor store cashier knows my name, calls it out to ask me if I'm doing okay. Throw a 20 out of me can keep the change, but I gotta get this bullet from the bottle to my brain. If I had a needle, I would put it in my veins.
Jason Hawk Harris says he's in a much better place right now, but the past few years have been difficult. He dabbled in abusive behavior during that time, and his mother died after a long bout with alcohol. Yet the music he writes around these themes is often upbeat, even danceable. Harris said it's not something he necessarily does consciously.
I seem to write my most hopeful melodies whenever I'm the most sad. What seems to come out is a sound that's more hopeful. I'm not really sure why, but that's just always been the case for me. Even when I was younger, I remember writing sad songs that sounded really happy.
Oh, I wish that where I am was where I've been.
A recent viral video of CNN's Anderson Cooper asking TV talk show host Stephen Colbert about how, as a Catholic, he can not only accept but be grateful for the suffering that comes with existence. Colbert argued that you can't accept being alive without accepting everything that comes with it, and that includes suffering. Harris says he agrees with Colbert on that sentiment, though they define their terms differently.
I am not so much grateful for the crucible of suffering as I am grateful for the refining that happens. I certainly am grateful for the place I'm in now, the wisdom that I've gotten from going through so much pain and hardship in the past 5-6 years. I mean, I think a lot of this record is sort of, that's funny, it's sort of geared towards that ethos a little bit.
Starting not to work at all, so today I'm trying to stay away from alcohol. Sweating and it feels like my head's on wrong. Hands are getting shaky, it's my own damn fault. If you wanna leave, well that's my own damn fault.
WGLT's John Norton talking with Jason Hawk Harris, who plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. You can hear Harris's music on WGLT's Highway 309 at WGLT.org. You can discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois in the WGLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Let's hear a bit more from Jason Hawk Harris.
This heart of mine, this heart of mine. If I'm blacked out at some party trying to fill the hole you left. But one day I'll be fine, I'll forget you in good time. For now I'll medicate this beat down heart of mine.
Jason Hawk Harris, who plays tomorrow night at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington.
Turning now to local history, one of Bloomington Normal's early feminists, Anna Mae Christian, was proud to live her life as a single woman at the turn of the 20th century. This episode of our podcast, McHistory, details Christian's life as a feminist and leader of the Amateur Musical Club.
I was always too independent. This is McKenna Lockhart, and I am with the Evergreen Memorial Cemetery Walk.
This is Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History. Anna Mae Christian is certainly one of the more fascinating individuals we've encountered, rediscovered, if you will, in the archives at the McLean County Museum of History. She was born in 1866 in Decatur, but at the age of 10 or 11, her family moves to Bloomington, and there Anna Mae Christian, she went by Mae for most of her time in Bloomington, would live until her passing in 1941 at the age of 74. She lived her entire time in Bloomington at the family home at the 500 block of East Front Street. Unfortunately, that home is still there today, which is nice, in the Dimmitt's Grove neighborhood.
Some women have men to work for them. I have to work for myself.
So obviously we're hearing in this scrapbook is the voice of someone who's proud to be independent, who, yes, had several suitors in her life, but spurned those suitors, perhaps because she felt they weren't worthy of her, or she was happy enough in her independent life as a woman, and certainly made no bones about it and was very comfortable in her skin.
I can borrow the neighbor's children.
So we've been hearing excerpts from Anna Mae Christian's, really what I think is almost a feminist manifesto. This very fiercely independent woman puts this scrapbook together, we think around 1903 from all the available evidence, and this is held in the archives of the McLean County Museum of History. So she puts together this scrapbook, this manifesto, which it really consists of a dozen or so pages really think of clip art images, one per page usually, and then a kind of a pithy but very knowing statement or observation. For example, she has a kind of an illustration of a man reading a newspaper, and she says,
"This is the way some men entertain their wives."
That's her comment about that scene. She also, on another page, says,
"I never would be spoony."
S-P-O-O-N-Y. "I would never be spoony," Anna Mae Christian says. And that's to be, it's a word we don't use anymore, but it's to be sentimentally or foolishly flirtatious. So she would never be that kind of woman.
"Still unoccupied."
Anna Mae Christian is circulating in the latter half of the 19th and into the 20th century in Bloomington, where there are a lot of educated girls and women, and this is the height of patriarchy, so occupational opportunities are relatively restricted for women. Women need an outlet, so oftentimes they're forming organizations such as clubs or societies or teas. Bloomington is known as kind of a community of clubs because you have all this excess intelligence and vigor and civic pride and energy that has to be channeled into these organizations because women are denied equal opportunities, whether it's in business or economics or politics, certainly. So Anna Mae Christian is involved in this kind of environment of women giving papers to each other in living rooms and playing classical music in parlors before friends and associates and things of that nature. So Anna Mae Christian becomes a member of the History Club in the 1890s, a well-known one of these local clubs, and is giving papers such as Modern Music or American Composers to that club. A few years later, she becomes a charter member of the Bloomington Women's Club. And about that same year, this would be 1897, she joins a relatively new organization in the Twin Cities known as the Amateur Musical Club, and that is the organization she will be associated with. And the Amateur Musical Club is really a titan in the cultural landscape of the Twin Cities for much of the 19th and well into the 20th century. And Anna Mae Christian played a pivotal role in making this one of the better-known musical organizations or clubs in all of downstate Illinois. Illinois, if not the Midwest. So she goes on to serve as president of the Amateur Musical Club for some 12 years, beginning in 1910. And that year, the first year she's president, she works with Florence Pfeiffer Bohr. So again, you've got these very educated, politically savvy women that are kind of restricted until avenues begin to open up for them, like Florence Pfeiffer Bohr beginning to be able to run and serve in the Illinois Senate, for example. So it's Florence Pfeiffer Bohr and Anna Mae Christian bring in 1910, opera singer Minnie Saltzman Stevens, who was a hometown girl, if you will. She was born and bred in Bloomington, and they're able to bring her back for a big fundraiser, and it's one of the first big major events in the Amateur Musical Club's history. Fortunately, we had this really unique, remarkable object in our archives, this scrapbook she put together around 1903, kind of a proto-feminist manifesto by this woman who was not afraid to announce that she was unmarried and proud of it.
This episode of McHistory was produced by WGLT's Mary Cullen, featuring Bill Kemp of the McLean County Museum of History, and McKenna Lockhart with the Evergreen Memorial Cemetery Walk. Lockhart will play Anna Mae Christian at this year's Cemetery Walk, which takes place the first two weekends in October.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and John Norton. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM. We can follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. And Fall Fun Drive is over, but you can still contribute at WGLT.org. Thanks to everyone who took time out last week to make a contribution to help pay for what WGLT provides. Whether your reason is Morning Edition, this show, Sound Ideas, the new weekend or evening programs, all of it, we thank you. Your contribution, combined with money from hundreds of other listeners, helps pay for GLT on the air and online. So thank you. And if you still haven't taken time to contribute, go ahead and click on Donate at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.